Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Joyce Vance. Jill will be back next week. We are already missing her. We've got so much going on this week. We'll be talking about John Bolton's guilty plea. We will be talking about Donald Trump's nominations of both Bill Pulte to be the DNI and Todd Blanche to be the AG. It's sort of hard to know which one is worse. And then finally, we'll talk about the ongoing fallout from the Supreme Court's decision in Calais and what you need to know about an Alabama case that many people think is the death knell of the Voting Rights Act. So lots of hardcore, serious stuff at the intersection of law and politics this week. But before we get there, I have a summer question for y'all. I have become sort of obsessed in the last week with making a hot fudge sundae every night after dinner. And I've been sort of liberal in my interpretation of hot fudge because last night I had a caramel sundae with mascarpone ice cream, a local ice cream that I got at the grocery store here. I mean, it has been really, really fun. So what I need to know, what are your favorite ice cream flavors, y'all? Kim, I know you're an ice cream girl, aren't you?
Well, I have a very, very specific ice cream taste that I'm sure Barb, my fellow Detroiter, would understand a lot. So I think a lot of people don't know. Here's a fun fact. Everybody knows Stroh's, the beer company. Well, Stroh's needed something to do during Prohibition. So Stroh's started making ice cream. And Stroh's still makes ice cream. And I have to tell you, it is the most delicious creamy ice cream that you could ever get. Like I wouldn't eat Breyers or anything else growing up because Breyers tasted like chalk to me compared to Stroh's. And my favorite flavor to this day is black cherry. So sometimes when I go home to visit my family, my mom will buy some and have it in the freezer for me. But that when I think of the best ice cream ever, it is Stroh's black cherry. That may not make the best hot fudge sundae for you, but you know, you can experiment. But if you want fudge, again, Detroit classic Sanders fudge. We have it in our fridge right now here in DC. There is no better fudge. They also do caramel. It's just so delicious. Is this just me being nostalgic? I think my taste is maybe 25% nostalgia, but 75% legit deliciousness. So,
oh yeah, can't.
So where do I find Stroh's ice cream? Do I have to go to Detroit? Because I will.
I think I have only seen that in Michigan, but you can get Sanders fudge outside of Michigan, but I've only seen Stroh's ice cream at the Kroger in Michigan. So we'll try to find the way to ship you some, Joyce.
No, I'm going to go hang out at the McQuaid's house for a weekend. Barb, when can I come
out? We'll hook you up. I can't attest. Stroh's does make a good ice cream. Kim, I thought you might go with the Boston Cooler, which is Werner's over vanilla ice cream. Also good.
Also a classic.
Also a Detroit classic. Yeah, that's good stuff. And black cherry, you know, in the summertime, sometimes we go up north and if you're anywhere near Traverse City, you got to go with the black cherry ice cream. It's that's the only way to go. You know, I spent most of my life as a fruity ice cream girl, but I have to say in my advanced age, I've really shifted over to more of the cookie dough and salty caramel flavors. I have to say that's probably a tie. You know, salty caramel wasn't a thing, I don't think, when I was a kid, but it's become very popular and for good reason because it's very delicious. There's an ice cream parlor in Ann Arbor called Blank Slate, and they make great ice cream, and I am a sucker for their salty caramel. It's delicious.
You know, I think this is the problem with ice cream. There just isn't really a bad choice. And there was one summer when our kids were little, Bob got me an ice cream maker, and I got obsessed with making garden ice cream. Like I made this sherbet that was watermelon with basil in it. I did weird stuff like that, whatever was ripe. I never did make squash ice cream, although I threatened, and I still think it would be good, right? Make a custard with squash in it and then freeze it. It's not that different from pumpkin. Don't give me that look, Kimberly. I think it would be legit. Brown sugar and summer squash, I think that has potential.
I guess squash is technically a fruit, so okay.
You need a lot of brown sugar to make it worthwhile.
But I'm with Barb. I mean, I think salty caramel, oof, tough to beat. Summer always changes how we get dressed. The mood is lighter, the weather is uplifting,
And we want pieces that feel lighter and more breathable to match it. Pieces made with better materials that just look effortless and feel good the moment you put them on. That's why here at Hashtag Sisters-in-Law, we keep coming back to Quince. They focus on high-quality essentials like breathable linen, soft organic cotton, and washable silk, and it's all without the luxury markup. It's that rare balance where everything feels elevated but still easy. And Barb, you know, I just broke down. I don't usually do this for Bob, but I bought him 4 of their fabulous lightweight men's cotton t-shirts for summer. They're really gorgeous, and it didn't break the bank.
Yeah, Quince has really beautiful everyday pieces like the 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at $32. Their denim is soft and easy to wear, and their organic cotton sweaters are perfect for layering on cool summer nights. Best of all, everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands because Quince works directly with ethical factories to cut out the middlemen. Who are the middlemen anyway? I don't know who they are, but we always want to cut them out. And Quince does exactly that. That means you're paying for quality, not brand markup. It's not just their clothing. Quince has truly become a destination for elevated essentials across home, kitchen, bedding, and beyond, making it easy and affordable to bring a more premium feel into your everyday life.
As the weather heats up, everyone needs Quince's washable stretch silk blouse. The material feels amazing, and the style is really perfect, whether you're relaxing at home or enjoying the sun on vacation or taking care of business in the office. There's nothing better for looking your best. And now that summer is here, the ultimate workout motivation is the new activewear, like the micro rip-top mid-rise hike shorts from Quince. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/sisters for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. You get a whole year to decide if you like it. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/sisters for free shipping and 365-day returns. Again, it's quince.com/sisters, and the link is in our show notes.
Well, news reports indicate that John Bolton has reached a plea deal with the Justice Department. The former national security advisor was charged with disclosing classified information. And Kim, can you remind our listeners about the charges of John Bolton and what the reported terms of the plea deal are?
Yeah, so recall that John Bolton was originally hit with an 18-count indictment, and it stemmed from him writing his memoir and using what the Justice Department says was classified material in writing his personal notes in preparation for this memoir, and then using a messaging app to share more than 1,000 pages of this notes, which included, according to the Justice Department, national defense information with 2 family members, his wife and daughter, who do not and have not ever, as far as I know, held security clearance. So he entered into a plea deal, as you said, this week. And under the terms, he pled guilty to a pleaded guilty to a single count of illegal retention of classified information. And he will pay a fine of about $2.5 million. He could still face some jail time up to 5 years, but he also could get none. The general sentencing guidelines call for 0 to 5 years for this one charge. So that was a pretty interesting turn of events this week. But I think, as we'll get into and we've discussed before, I think his case was a little different than other classified documents investigations that we've seen.
Yeah, I agree with that. And by the way, Kim, you should know that the pleaded debate is one that rages in U.S. attorneys' offices. I always like you in the pleaded camp, but I know
slipped.
There are
no pled. I
pled. It is absolutely
yes,
pleaded. Pled. Pled, you guys. Pled.
That is a past
I will die on this hill. Pled.
I will die with you because it's
team pled.
This is how Preet Barb and Joyce
when
will
I
die.
Need him? You know, Barb was with Preet last Sunday. You were with Preet, right, last Sunday. And Preet, who is our colleague in the Southern District of New York, Preet is team pled along with me. So I don't know.
All right. So we'll do a cage fight.
Yeah. No. Oh, yeah.
Hey, we can do it at the White House, y'all. I mean, Trump's got that big old arch built. Let's go. Yeah.
Can I just interject, completely unrelated to any of this? I've been on this book tour this week, signing books, and I had two people come up to me and tell me, a book talk, with my book, they're buying my book, telling me how much they enjoy receiving my newsletter, Civil Discourse, with Joyce Vance. They think we're the same person.
I will never understand why people think that we look so much alike, but I am so deeply complimented by that so sorry you have to live with it,
Barb. No, Sam, it's very flattering. Just make sure you always uphold the brand.
All right, same, well, Joyce, girl.
Let's get back to the conversation about John Bolton. As Kim said, it's hard to find the right comparable. This case reminds me a little bit of the case against General Petraeus. Remember that? He was allowed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor. Do you think this is comparable to the Petraeus case? Is Bolton being treated more harshly, or do you think his case is different?
I think that comparison is a fair one, and it's an important one because the cases have real similarities, but there are also some meaningful differences that cut both ways. Both cases involve a senior national security official who's sharing classified material with unauthorized individuals for private purposes, not for espionage. That's the first key similarity.
Yeah.
But Bolton shares more than 1,000 pages of diary-like NSA notes, including information that's classified up to the top secret SCI level. And he does that with two family members who lack security clearances. Of course, Petraeus shared notes with his biographer/girlfriend, Paula Broadwell, but it was over a shorter period of time and fewer items. Importantly, though, neither man was accused of sharing information with a foreign adversary for money or for ideology. But the scale is just so very different. Bolton's conduct allegedly runs from April of 2018 to August of 2025. 7 years, over 1,000 pages of information. Some of the worst instances include intelligence about future attacks and sensitive information shared with the U.S. by a foreign partner. So very different from Petraeus in that sense. And then we get to the Iranian hack of Bolton. Yeah. Because he is, sharing this material constantly, and that makes him a target, and that really exposes the United States to serious, serious danger. So is Bolton being treated more harshly? That's the question that you pose, Barb. On the surface, yes, but the comparison is very complicated. Bolton's deal resolves this 18-count felony indictment Kim was talking about down to a single count of retention of classified information with a whopper of a fine in excess of $2 million and the possibility of avoiding prison, although that's not for certain. That's up to the judge.
Yeah, that's right. And, I think, as you mentioned to me, one of the key differences too, what they both did was a violation of the trust that they received in exchange for the privilege of serving and having access to America's secrets. But sending information over his private email is what John Bolton did. And that is what was apparently hacked. He got some response back from Marina, like, hey, John, guess what we have? We've got all this classified information. He fronted that himself to the FBI and said, it looks like I've been hacked. But that was how it was detected. And that's why you don't put this stuff over your, commercial private email or a signal chat for that matter, because there is that risk that it gets intercepted. And you're a target when you have a position of, sensitivity like the National Security Advisor.
Can I just be petty here for a second and say that Bolton is doing this on the same timeline where he and others are sharply critical of Hillary Clinton over the whole private server thing? Yep. And, hypocrisy bears its own rewards, right? But John Bolton is nothing if not hypocritical in this whole exercise.
Yeah, well, Kim, I also want to ask you about how it compares to some of the other cases we've been seeing more recently in the Trump administration. I think it was the Wall Street Journal today tried to group Bolton with Jim Comey and Letitia James saying, well, this is one more episode of weaponized Justice Department and going after Trump's enemies. Do you think that this case is legit, or is this just one more episode of Trump's retribution campaign?
Well, listen, I have no doubt that Trump is enjoying this, that he is thrilled because Bolton is such a became such a strong critic of Donald Trump and his actions. And I'm sure the fact that he faced charges in the first place may have had to do with the fact that it was under Pam Bondi in the Justice Department. But it's important for people to remember that, A, as we've pointed out, what he did was not good. It was very bad. And B, the investigation into this began during the Biden administration, unlike the probes into Letitia James and James Comey. So I don't think the origins of this were politically motivated. I think, as you said, he got this information from Iran. He took it to the FBI and an investigation was open. And that seems pretty much to me like the normal course of things. He also, again, he voluntarily went. So if you want to distinguish it from, oh, I don't know, President Trump's, he didn't try to stonewall or say that the documents were really his or anything like that. So it does not feel particularly politically motivated. I don't know, at the time in the Biden administration, they investigated and they chose at the time not to bring charges. They made that decision and it reversed in the Trump administration. Was that political? Quite possibly. But it doesn't take away from the fact that what he did was wrong. It was illegal. And I'm glad that he's taking responsibility and striking this plea deal. I think that was the right thing for him to do.
Yeah. And, you know, can I just add to what Kim is saying? Because I think these cases, there's always a dimension that the public is maybe less aware of, but that's important. Because to prosecute a John Bolton in court, the government has a real problem on its hands. And this may be why the Biden administration didn't go forward. Inevitably, in order to prove your case, there's some classified information that gets exposed. And that can be very difficult and very dicey to navigate. And sometimes, I mean, that, quite frankly, is, I think, why with Petraeus, he was permitted to plead to a misdemeanor charge. Now we've got Bolton, who will plead to a felony. He really benefits like crazy from this deal. The idea that he won't have to do jail time, and probably the judge will sentence with a light hand, if for no other reason than because the judge will know that this is not someone that the Bureau of Prisons wants to have to keep safe while they're in prison. He would go to a facility probably like Talladega, which is in North Alabama, my district, which has a minimum security camp, which he would be eligible for. Tough to keep somebody who has a bounty on his head from Iran safe in that sort of a setting. So I think he cut a really favorable deal for himself. The government has less exposure for what they have to put forward. But the point that I'm trying to make with this long, dragged out comment is that these cases are difficult. And what sometimes looks like just a slap on the wrist as opposed to the gut punch that these guys deserve for doing this is to keep the rest of us safe, to protect national security.
Yeah, it's difficult to try a case like this without revealing some of the very secrets that you were concerned about protecting in the first place. Well, let me just wrap up by asking you both, what effect, if any, this case has on the way we ought to view President Trump's own retention of national defense information? Does this just amplify, this is a big deal, this is a crime? Or does it suggest that it all depends on who you are and what kind of treatment you get?
Well, I feel like in this case, there are clear through lines that show the difference between Trump's case and literally every other classified documents investigation, including that into former President Joe Biden and former Vice President Mike Pence. It has to do with how much you cop to it, how much you cooperate, how much you take responsibility, as opposed to completely pretending like you're a king and everything you touch is yours, even when it deals with national security. I shudder to think about what is going to go on at the end of this term in Trump, because he was let off the hook by, and this is part of the problem with Aileen Cannon. He was totally let off the hook with this. So we've seen how the president operates. Once he gets away with something, he takes it. Once he's given an inch, he takes 3 miles. Look at the immunity decision. And he's now, ever since then, he's acted like a king. I think now, I mean, I don't, there's no telling where classified documents are. He's probably already stashing them away in anticipation because he doesn't think that the law applies to him. So I think the lesson he learned was exactly the wrong one, but his case is so different from any of these other classified cases, even John Bolton's, which again, he did something wrong. It's not even a comparison.
Yeah, I think Kim absolutely nails it. I have very little to add except to say, and this is to the point that you're making, Trump goes above and beyond the original crime by obstructing justice, right? By lying about it, by trying to withhold documents from the government. Everything about Trump's situation is very different from these other cases. You know, Donald Trump never came in and you know, never said, look, I'd like to plead guilty to a misdemeanor. And his case might have been very different had he done that. But this is someone who can never acknowledge when he's wrong.
The internet is still the Wild West, and it's full of stalkers and scammers and hackers. You know you should protect yourself, but how? It's actually easier than you might think. Here's what you do. Go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code sisters to get 20% off Delete Me. Delete Me removes your personal information that's being sold online, which is why you really need to get it. In the age of AI, we are all especially vulnerable to scammers using your personal data that's floating around on the internet against you. Have you ever Googled yourself and found your home address, phone number, or the name of a family member? It's unsettling, and there's a lot worse out there. The good news is, Delete Me can help.
Yeah, Barb, I thought I always practiced pretty good online safety hygiene and not putting my, you know, identifying information out there on purpose. But when I got Delete Me, I was really shocked at what came up in the reports. Those folks can really get a hold of all kinds of information about you. And Delete Me is great because it does all the hard work to wipe your personal information from data broker websites. And you can get an individual plan for a little over $8 per month, even if you're not a public figure. In the internet age, all of us are potential targets for malicious actors, blackmailers, and worse. And especially if you have kids in your family, Delete Me really is a must. Once you get started with them, the peace of mind is such a relief. I trust them to protect me and my sisters and my loved ones, and I know they can help keep you and your family safe too.
Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for our listeners, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and use promo code SISTERS at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to www.joindeleteme.com/sisters and enter code SISTERS at checkout. That's www.joindeleteme.com/sisters. Code Sisters. The link is in the show notes. With summer here, it's time to escape the house, take a vacation, and enjoy being out and about. And nothing makes it easier to take on the world than looking and feeling your best. That's why it's so important to have a daily routine that gets you feeling confident and ready to embrace the day. For me, an essential part of that is using my ever-growing stash of Thrive Cosmetics. I don't know about y'all, but I just can't resist Thrive's new colors and new products, and I use them to put together fresh looks so my glow matches the sunshine. A total refresh can be as simple as amplifying your look with clean beauty from Thrive Cosmetics. Every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin, not against it. We know you'll be a huge fan of their products, too.
You know, I love Thrive's mascara, lip balm, eyebrow tint, so much that I'm wearing all of them right now. But I also really love their new Empower Matte Precision Lipstick Crayon. It's your new best age-defying friend for lips that have lived a little. The long-wearing, weightless lip perfection formula can be worn as both a liner or layered for a bold, opaque finish that leaves your lips looking luscious and fuller. Right now, I'm obsessed with the best-selling Kajsa. It's a beautiful, dusty rose color. I'm wearing it for, you know, you can't see me, but I'm wearing some florals right now, and the dusty rose goes very well with it. But you can pick from 18 buildable shades. It's fun finding the perfect fit for your mood or style. So start indulging your lips with creamy, long-lasting velvet matte color that's packed with staying power.
Another thing we love about Thrive Cosmetics is that Cause is in the name for a reason. Thrive not only defines luxury beauty with their uncompromising standards, but they give back too. Every time you use Thrive, you're doing more than enhancing your glow. You're helping others shine too. With more than $150 million in product and cash donations to 600 plus giving partners, your purchase directly fuels real impact. Imagine making a difference in things like education, the fight against cancer, stopping domestic abuse, and more with every purchase. That's beauty with purpose. Don't wait. Amplify your summer look with Thrive Cosmetics. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/sisters for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/sisters. The link is in our show notes.
Well, this was the week of some pretty bad luck for some of Donald Trump's cabinet nominees. It seems that the fact that fealty has become the number one qualification that the president seeks in choosing who is in his cabinet is starting to come back to bite him, because the higher the fealty, maybe the lower the qualifications. I don't know. It seems that some of his latest picks are even too much for Senate Republicans to swallow. To wit, Joyce, tell us about Bill Pulte, Trump's choice to replace Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence. He's deeply steeped in the intelligence community, is he not? Why was he picked?
Oh, yeah, so deeply steeped. Yeah, just like a fine tea. Look, Bill Pulte has zero qualification for this job. He might be able to build you a house, or he might be able to boss around the guys that can build you a house, but he doesn't know anything about being the Director of National Intelligence. And something that we've all been talking about this week, you know, most cabinet level jobs don't have a statutory qualification, but the DNI has to be somebody with deep, extensive experience in national security. That's not Bill Pulte, and that's why Trump is putting him in place as the acting rather than trying to get him confirmed, because he is absolutely unconfirmable. He has that one quality that matters to Trump, Kim. You know, I was going to say loyalty. I love that you say fealty, because I think we're not very far away from the moment where King Trump sits on a throne and makes people walk up the carpet towards him and kneel before he knights them. I mean, we're awfully close to that. Pulte has a track record that a Donald Trump loves, because he used his position at Fannie and Freddie to pull mortgage documentation. And that's right. What led to the, although it's now been dismissed, but to the prosecution of Tish James, the New York Attorney General. There was a case that was never formally brought, but that Trump used as an excuse to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook. So Pulte has really delivered for Trump up until now, and Trump is clearly counting on more of the same.
Yeah, and he's done it all while not exactly making friends along the way, even within the cabinet. One of my favorite Bill Pulte stories is the fact that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent reportedly had words with him at the White House and threatened to punch him in the bleeping face. So he seems like a real nice guy.
Just a normal, ordinary cabinet level exchange, man. Come on, Kim. Don't be so picky.
Okay. So Barb, you know, as we've hinted at, not all GOP senators are into him. In fact, you know, as Joyce pointed out, it looks like his run at DNI may not last very long. What do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, even today, President Trump said, it's just temporary. He won't last that long. Don't worry about it.
Just long enough to mess with the election, yeah.
Well, a couple of things about
that.
So I know John Thune, who's the Senate Majority Leader, said, this is an important position. We can't have a politicized director of national intelligence. And Mitch McConnell said, this is a position that requires extensive experience and we will not stand for anyone who's not qualified. So I thought that was interesting. But, you know, it doesn't require a Senate confirmation to be in acting. And he's going to be there for 210 days. That's 7 months. And one of the things President Trump has suggested he'll do is, you know, you have a lot more flexibility when you're in acting. And he wants him to fire people in the intelligence community so that the incoming director of national intelligence will have a clean slate. And why? Who do you want to fire? And why do you want to fire him? It's just too big. Which jobs, which job descriptions do you think are unnecessary, Mr. President? You may recall Doge was in there cutting jobs, they just slashed jobs kind of willy-nilly. And it turned out they also slashed people who were in charge of the nuclear program. And they, oops, well, you better bring those people back. So I worry about that. And as Joyce said, you know, what could possibly go wrong in these 7 months? It's a really long time. We are at war with Iran, a state sponsor of terrorism. Yeah. The reason we have a director of national intelligence is because after 9/11, Congress concluded, based on the 9/11 commission, that there was a lack of one centralized leader over all 18 intelligence agencies to make sure we were connecting the dots. That's the job of the Director of National Intelligence. Also to lead the president's daily brief on what are the most urgent threats, what happened overnight. That's the person. And we've got Bill Pulte, who has no experience in this regard. I think it's incredibly dangerous to have someone like this at the helm.
Hey, Kim, can I know that this is sort of a little bit off topic, but I think it is on topic. And Barb is our national security expert.
She is.
Barb, the FISA is due. Section 702 is due to be re-upped. Warrantless collection on foreign subjects. Can you talk a little bit about how Democrats might be able to use that to get some leverage over Pulte?
Yes. So Section 702 is an important part of the national security toolkit, as they like to say, but it is one that is controversial because it allows the intelligence community to collect communications of non-U.S. persons who are overseas as the targets. But of course, they sometimes talk to American citizens. And so even though they're collecting on targets who are non-U.S. citizens overseas, In the collection data are conversations and text messages and emails with U.S. persons. The intelligence community is able to query all of that data without a warrant if it relates to an intelligence purpose, not a criminal investigation. That means all of us. And if you have someone who is not carefully following the rules, one could worry about whether they're going to use that to collect information on, you know, say, Trump's enemies. But it presents this perhaps opportunity. There is a strong desire to renew its sunsets from time to time, which forces Congress to review it before they can reauthorize it.
Yeah, they're reviewing it right now.
Yeah, and so that timing, is suggesting could be used as a package, right, as a lever to say, if you want this authority, which you very much want, if you want us to continue it, then we need a director of national intelligence who is someone with the required extensive experience in intelligence. So I think they have an opportunity here to withhold their approval of the renewal of Section 702 if the president persists in pushing even an acting director of national intelligence without any experience.
Yeah, and I'm going to spitball here, and think that they may get some Republicans to join them too, because I know some like Lisa Murkowski have really not been thrilled with this Pulte appointment one bit. And they've even tried to bar him from simultaneously serving as acting DNI and also remaining in I keep forgetting the name of the administration that he's also
moved, like, yeah.
Yes, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, where he is authorized to dig up dirt on the people that Donald Trump doesn't like. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. But we would be remiss if we did not spend a little bit of time focusing on one of our favorite subjects, acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, who really, really wants the permanent job so bad, so much so that he tried to set up a slush fund for Donald Trump and his buddies, his supporters, including January 6 rioters, fell apart, but not as to Donald Trump. Barb, things aren't looking so great for him in the Senate either, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's. I think John Thune said it's hard to say. You know, the majority leader.
And that's bad. Okay, when the majority leader is like. That's not a good sign.
Yeah, you know, Charles Grassley, who has often been an opponent of DOJ, he has said, like, oh, of course it's good to go. We approved him a little over a year ago for the deputy position. It's the same guy. And so I expect him to sail through. But there are others. And, you know, there's some people now who have been liberated from their allegiance to Donald Trump, like John Cornyn, who lost his primary election in face of opposition by Donald Trump, and Senator Cassidy. So there's some people there who may be able to vote. Tom Tillis, another. They may be able to vote their conscience here because of they are no longer seeking a seat to run for re-election. But I think one thing that's very different from the Senate confirmation vote that occurred when Todd Blanche was nominated for Deputy Attorney General, which is early 2025, is now we have seen what he is like at the helm. He led the review and release of the Epstein files. And by accounts of members of Congress, there are still many documents that have yet to be disclosed because he is holding on to deliberative process privilege, despite the fact that the statute itself said that should not be honored. We've seen the way he has overseen indictments against the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Seychelles case, and that he even tried to put together this slush fund for Trump. And even though, here's the cynic in me, they were pretty quick to walk back the compensation fund for weaponization victims. Like, okay, forget about it. We won't do that. They have not walked back what may have been the real important crux of the deal, which was to give Trump immunity from audits and civil claims from the IRS for anything he might have done in the past. Some experts estimate that his past tax bill is over $100 million. You know, Trump doesn't care about his supporters, right? Like, oh, okay, yeah, forget, we'll walk that back. What he really wants is this $100 million gift. And so it may be that this set of experiences that we have seen Todd Blanche participate in might make it a different vote that we see than we saw a year and a half ago.
You know, can I add one other element in too?
Yeah.
Because the thing about Todd Blanche is there's something for everybody to hate here, right? I mean, Barb has covered the key ones, but there's so much more with Blanche. And if you're in a close race in a state or in a district where people care about the Epstein survivors, the victims of Epstein, Todd Blanche is the guy who went to a federal prison, interviewed Ghislaine Maxwell, and gave her the sweetheart deal of a lifetime. She's now sitting in a minimum security facility where she is not eligible to be by virtue of her conviction. She's got like a puppy that she's raising. She gets good food.
Wait, it's a puppy?
She does. She has
a puppy.
You know that program BOP does where they let inmates raise service dogs or something like that for the first year? She's in on that. I mean, here's the deal, right? If you are, take your pick of Republicans in tight races, and this could be a difficult year for them in any event, and you're thinking about how this is going to play in late October when your opponent, when the Democrat that you're running against, starts coming out and talking about what happened with Ghislaine Maxwell, I think you may be very hesitant to vote to confirm Todd Blanche. To be honest with y'all, I'm not really sure he'll even come up for a vote.
Wow. Okay.
We'll keep an eye on that. Maybe sycophancy doesn't pay off in the end after all.
Loyalty is a one-way street in the Trump administration. Just remember that.
I love seafood. I love seafood. I really do. I can eat it every day.
I can tell. Wow.
But I also don't love going to the grocery store. I may have mentioned that too. But one reason is when you get to the fish section, you never know where it came from or what might be in it or how fresh it is or whether it's sustainable. And even worse, you never know how long it's been sitting out on display. I don't always believe the dates that are stamped on it. I'm sorry. I'm distrustful, y'all. I don't believe it. So when it comes to my home and all of our homes, we need a provider we can trust, which is why we want to tell you about Wild Alaskan Company. They offer the best way to get wild-caught, high-quality seafood delivered to your door on your schedule. Trust us, you've never tasted fish this good. We are having Wild Alaskan sockeye salmon. It's one of my favorite things to eat.
Mm-hmm. We always recommend them. And it's wonderful to know our listeners, friends, and family are all getting the best. Each Wild Alaskan box comes with individually portioned, vacuum-sealed fillets that are easy to prep and great for any meal, whether it's quick or elevated. All of their fish is quick-frozen, fresh from Alaskan waters, which helps lock in its freshness, texture, flavor, and key nutrients like omega-3s. Better yet, there are no GMOs, antibiotics, or other additives to their catch, which means it's fish you can trust.
We really love how every order supports sustainable harvesting practices and Alaskan fishermen whose history is tied to the region and its practices. Plus, becoming a member means your deliveries are flexible and at your own pace. It's an endless smorgasbord of truly feel-good seafood. I love also, aside from the sockeye salmon, and I really do love the Pacific halibut, for a tasty treat that's low in fat, high in protein, and rich in omega-3s. It's really delicious and flaky whitefish that turns a savory-looking bright white when you cook it, and it's perfect whether you sear it or throw it on the grill. If you're feeling adventurous, it's also amazing in tacos or curry. I made fish tacos with it and it was a big hit in my house. You need to try it all. And there are so many other amazing choices. I've also enjoyed the Alaskan snow crab, which is one of my favorite foods in the world.
You know, I'm a huge fan of using fish to make soup. And even during the summer, there's just something really comforting about a chowder. You don't always think about doing that with fish. But, you know, when I've got some of this fish in my freezer, I just go there and 30 minutes before the meal, I pull out some Wild Alaskan. I sort of stir it around in the pot with some potatoes and some onions. And then I use it to make soup with whatever herbs and greens I have on hand. And the recipe almost doesn't matter. It's just so delicious. Wild Alaskan Company is so confident that their fish is the best that they offer a 100% satisfaction and money-back guarantee. So you can try your first box risk-free. Go to wildalaskan.com/sisters for $35 off your first order of premium wild-caught seafood. That's wildalaskan.com/sisters for $35 off your first order. Thanks to Wild Alaskan Company for sponsoring this episode and for making all of our dinners more delicious. The link is in our show notes. We've spent a lot of time lately discussing the Supreme Court's decision in Calais. That's the gerrymandering case. I know you guys know all about it. Voting rights are critically important, and voting is the right that unlocks all of the other rights. We've also, after Calais, we've touched on this Alabama case called Milligan. It's a case that the Supreme Court decided 3 years ago, and Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh joined the three progressive justices in a very fragile majority that forced the state to redraw its maps. You know, we found out just how fragile that majority was when Alabama went back to the court for permission to revert essentially to its old maps after Calais was on. And shocker, the Supreme Court gave them permission to do that. And that happened even after a panel of judges, two Trump appointees on that panel, found that those maps had been drawn with an intent to discriminate against Black voters. America in 2026. So, Kim, you wrote a fantastic column about this on Thursday. Can you share the points you made with us and talk about why everybody across the country, not just people in Alabama, need to be worried about Milligan?
Absolutely. I mean, this case is absolutely infuriating. I will push back on one little thing you said, Joyce, when you were saying that Roberts and Kavanaugh joined the progressive justices. The more I read what the three Democratic appointed justices write about voting rights and a host of other things, I actually don't think they're progressive. I actually think what they are trying to do is hold on to the jurisprudence over, in this case, the Voting Rights Act that has had existed for six decades, including nearly the first half of the Roberts Court and how it was applied. They're holding steady to the way. I think sometimes because we think of politics as being very polarized right now, we talk about the conservatives on the court and the liberals as if they're at the same point in the poll. I think the conservatives are way over here. And the three in dissent are, generally speaking, kind of somewhere center left.
You know, that's such a good point, though. I'm glad you raised that, right? Because progressives want to restore the Voting Rights Act. They want this new measure in Congress to pass. I think you're dead right. They're just trying to hold on to something that they can pick up two votes from the conservatives for to try to hold on. So that's a good point.
They are just trying to apply the Voting Rights Act and the Constitution to it the way that it has been for 6 years.
I wonder until the labels should be changed, right? Are you know, Kagan and Sotomayor and Jackson now the conservatives trying to hold on to the past? And the others are sort of the
originalists,
right?
And the textualist originalists.
Like, you know, Justice Jackson is in fact a textualist.
She is.
Textualist in
she
many
very
ways.
Much is. I've written about that too. But anyway, the Milligan case. So let's start right. So recall that Calais essentially held, although the majority claims it wasn't the holding, but essentially held the only way you can bring a Section 2 case alleging racial gerrymandering is to show intent. I mean, that's if you read Kagan's very, very good dissent in that case. There's no other way to read the case because they make it nearly impossible to bring a disparate impact claim alleging voter dilution of Black votes, even when the record is as clear as it was in Louisiana. Right. So there's only intentional discrimination. Well, in Alabama, there was a three-judge panel, two of the judges appointed by Trump, that have found since 2021 repeatedly that Alabama intentionally racially gerrymandered their map to pack all the majority of Black voters into one district when they had enough numbers to have a second opportunity district. It doesn't mean it has to be majority Black. All it means is that you have enough Black people there to be able to have the voting power to elect a candidate of their choice. That's the language of the Voting Rights Act. And that they found in a ruling that was in excess of 500 pages, replete with evidence, that the legislature in Alabama did it on purpose, intentionally packed them into that district in order to help Republicans win. Well, the Supreme Court remanded that case for some reason after Calais to that three-judge panel to say, hey, take another look at this in light of Calais. Now, I'm like, well, what do you mean, Calais? This is intentional. Gerrymandering case. It has nothing to do with Calais, right? Well, then in a shadow docket, unsigned order dropped on Tuesday night at 9:14 p.m. Eastern Time, the court held that the three-judge panel erred because, one, they failed to give Alabama lawmakers the, quote, presumption of legislative good faith.
Can I just say, I'm an Alabama voter, right? I read the newspapers. I talk to these guys. Not only was there discriminatory intent, They were proud of it. They wanted to tell you all about it. Yeah.
You had the House Speaker after the first time when the Supreme Court ruled against them in this same case and said that it was intentional discrimination. He basically said, you know what? It was 5-4. So all we have to do is wait it out.
And then Alabama went in. They refused to draw new maps. They drew up a discriminatory map. The three-judge panel actually had to hire an expert to draw maps for the state. So, like, it wasn't a close call here.
No, it really wasn't. And they also had the nerve in this per curiam decision, which means nobody had the guts to sign it. But I don't know, in my personal opinion, it feels like an Alito joint to me. we talked about the Purcell principle, which means that courts are not supposed to change election rules on the eve of an election. Now, I don't know about y'all, but to me, June in a midterm year feels like the eve of an election. And the Supreme Court held that the three-judge panel can't act now because it's too close to the election. But Alabama lawmakers are perfectly free. It doesn't apply to them. They can change all the rules right up until they think it's fit to change it. So that gives states in the South and elsewhere with history of racial gerrymandering a blueprint. All they have to do is wait out the clock until courts can do nothing about it and then put their gerrymander in and know that there's no other court that can do that. In doing this, though, the Supreme Court itself violated the Purcell principle because they are the cause of all of this. It's the most outrageous shadow docket in the literal dark of night ruling that the Supreme Court has ever made on voting rights, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
You know, it's so hard to explain this because it's so far inside baseball, but appellate courts are supposed to give sort of a presumption to trial courts' decisions about what the facts are. And in the absence of clear air, they're not supposed to change them. And here where the evidence is strong, solid, in your face. I mean,
500 pages.
You might think that the Supreme Court would have been a little bit upset that the Alabama legislature took the point of view that it didn't have to follow the dinky little Supreme Court's direction to them. But no, they're like, Alabama, have at it, girl. And you know, the problem is this case is about gerrymandering. I can see all sorts of bad outcomes down the road where if you're a clever, coercive state legislature, maybe you decide to adopt new rules in the state legislature 3 days before the election. This is a freaking disaster. And I started out by saying voting is the right that unlocks all the other rights. I mean, Barb, what are your concerns? We've got this 1-2 punch from Clay and Milligan. Where do you think this ends up?
I now think that it's just open season for gerrymandering, including race-based gerrymandering. You know, I had taken the view that I think was wrong-headed that Chief Justice Roberts in particular, but much of this court, has this sort of colorblind view of the world, which is lovely, but that's not the world we live in. And Congress has found that it is a compelling interest to promote voting rights. The court has even recognized that as recently as Calais, the Supreme Court, even in Alito's opinion, said, we're not overturning the Voting Rights Act because there is this compelling interest in protecting voting rights. And that means providing these opportunity districts. But, you know, we don't see it here because there was no intent to discriminate. Now, I have gone on a tirade before about why that's the wrong standard. Congress even legislated this in 1982 and said, we don't care about what your intent was. It isn't that's nice try. It is you get equal rights to vote. And so discriminatory effect has always been enough. But what they said in Calais is discriminatory effect is not enough. There has to be intent to discriminate, which even when Calais came out, I said, that's going to be really hard to prove because it will be really easy to show discriminatory effect without being able to show discriminatory intent unless people say it out loud. Well, now, all that presumption of misguided, colorblind, you know, intent, I thought, well, they're misguided. But now that's all off the table, right? This is a map that the court found was violated the Voting Rights Act, that they found had a discriminatory intent. And now they say, well, you ought to give the benefit of the doubt to the legislature. Wait, what? We've got evidence. Courts have found evidence of intent to discriminate. So where does that leave us?
I don't know, because, you know, they had surrendered on political gerrymandering in the Rucho case and said, yeah, it's a political question we can't touch. Now it seems that even racial discrimination is beyond the purview of courts. And so feels like it's open season. And as we saw in Tennessee, right, they busted up, cracked in the term of gerrymandering, cracked up Memphis. So there's no longer a cohesive district that encompasses Memphis. It's been divided up into three separate districts. So you've got, yep, a little bit of Memphis and some suburbs, and another little bit of Memphis and some suburbs, and then a third bit of Memphis and some suburbs, which now means there's no Memphis block, predominantly, right, Black, that can
spread out the Black people. Exactly. And if you look, exactly, at Kagan's dissent in Calais, she starts off with a hypothetical.
Yeah, that's exactly the Memphis scenario.
That exactly, yeah, that's exactly what it is.
So I would say the only path back that I can see is one that is existent in some states, including Michigan, where we have a independent redistricting commission. It is not partisan. It's got members who are Republicans, members who are Democrats, members who are independent. And they are the ones who do the redistricting. And they've created, guess what? Fair districts. They respect county and city borders, so they're not splitting up communities. They respect communities of interest. They have to be of relatively equal size and shape, so they're not doing these crazy snakes to try to, you know, pack or crack groups. And it largely works. In fact, in the election right after the redistricting last time, the first election, the Michigan House and Senate went Democratic for the first time in 40 years. So, you know, it allows people to actually have the choice that they want to have. The initiative was called Voters, Not Politicians.
So, Kim, Barb raised a really interesting point. I take the point about Michigan and independent commissions, which I think is such a great approach. I'd like to see the Alabama legislature try to pass that law, though. I fear it won't happen with their viewpoint, which we've discussed. But Barb raised another really interesting point when she said that this is a court, the majority of which did not say that the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. They didn't say it in Calais about Section 2. They didn't say it in Shelby County versus Holder about Section 5. They just said the way it's being used, or in Calais, they changed the standard and make it undoable. Do you think, Kim, that there might be another path back? Could Congress possibly fix this if there are pro-democracy majorities after the midterm?
Well, the problem, so first of all, as to the court saying, oh, no, we didn't do that. That's called throwing rocks and hiding your hands. You absolutely,
yeah, no kidding,
did it. You just don't want to say that you did it. That's called gaslighting. And I really hate that in this unsigned shadow docket order that came out at 9:14 at night, that Chief Justice John Roberts or Justice Brett Kavanaugh had the cojones to explain why their ruling, what happened in the 3 years since they said that Alabama intentionally gerrymandered with this map, to turn around and change their mind completely and not even have to explain themselves. I'm sorry. But the problem with congressional action when it comes to Calais is that this was a constitutional ruling. They ruled that these provisions of the Voting Rights Act violated the Equal Protection Clause because it trampled on the rights of white voters. So when it's a constitutional ruling, that limits Congress's ability to go in and legislate that away. So they've really broken something fundamentally. So I know, you know, in talking to people who are doing the hard work, like Kristen Clark, who was formerly head of the Civil Rights Division at Justice under the Biden administration, who has been working on voting rights her whole career, they think, you know, getting out to vote and getting people who believe in justice is still important to pass things like the John Lewis Act that will restore a lot of what is being broken in this case. There's still a lot for Congress to do. I don't want to be pessimistic about it, yes. But when it comes to this constitutional ruling in Calais, we will have to wait for a Supreme Court to see the damage that it has done, how this is as bad as Dred Scott, and actually overturn that.
Yeah, I think this is such an important line that you're drawing. Section 5, Shelby County, the court invalidates the criteria that's being used, not the law. So Congress could come back and act. That's the John Lewis Act as part of that. But there's not been any traction in Congress in, yeah, lo these many years, right? I mean, we're at 10 plus years now on that one. And what happened in Calais is devastating. because of the constitutional ruling. Could Congress find a way back? You know, maybe they could. But as Kim says, it will take a different configuration or a different attitude on the Supreme Court. I guess this court has been so changeable. 3 years ago, this was unconstitutional. Who knows? You know, maybe when Barb McQuaid wins the presidency in 2028, maybe the Supreme Court will sing a different tune after that.
In your dreams. Or nightmares, as the case may be.
You know, because if you got elected, man, then everybody would be like accosting me going, President McQuaid, President.
You got my vote, Barb. If I still have a vote.
We love cats, and those of us who have them can't say enough great things about Smalls. Like a lot of you, for the longest time, I thought that the cat kibble they had in the grocery store was the way to go. It's right next to all the food I buy for my family, so it has to be good, right? Wrong. Once I found out that it was mostly filler, corn, and ingredients you can barely pronounce, I knew my cats deserved better. And I sort of knew why they had been looking at me with disdain during mealtime. You know, they are cats. But now that I've made the switch to Smalls, my cats and also my wonderful grand cat, Marty, who I'm taking care of this week, they have so much more energy. Their fur is softer. Marty is so pleasant to have sitting in my lap. I think he'll show up for part of the podcast today. And they just look better and feel better. If you're a cat parent, there's no better time to try Smalls than right now. Just ask Marty.
You know, if cats could text, they would not text you back. I saw that on social media. That's not an original joke, but I thought it was really funny.
I don't know, though, Barb. Like, my cats would be texting like, hey, woman, need more food or whatever. Come scratch my back. I can't even imagine what the cat text would look like.
Smalls fresh cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients you'd find in your fridge. And it gets conveniently delivered right to your door. In addition to Joyce, they have so many outstanding reviews. One that stood out said, Smalls has been the best decision I have made for my cat. He absolutely loves his food. His coat is shiny and he licks the bowl clean. High quality products, no artificial fillers or byproducts. Absolutely love Smalls.
You know, I'm not surprised. Cats use protein as their main energy source, and more protein means more fuel and sustained energy. Smalls fresh, gently cooked, preservative-free cat food gives them high protein and improved hydration for strong bones and toned muscles. Does Small make food for people? Because I could use some strong bones and toned muscles.
I was just thinking that, right? And it would really help with getting all the protein social media keeps telling me I need to get.
Right? Plus, a balanced diet leads to less shedding, fewer hairballs, and more silky shine. I think I need those things too. Even better, lots of nutrients in Smalls food are digestible, so less junk comes out the other end. And that means less cat-related odors, and that's something we can all appreciate.
That was very, right, Barb? That was very delicately stated. I appreciate that.
Even Barb survived that one.
Very diplomatically put. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, presumably in their cats, though they probably became healthier too with a happy cat. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they will refund you if your cat won't eat their food. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts for a limited time. Because you are a hashtag sisters-in-law listener, you can get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life. I think, again, for your cat. When you head to smalls.com/sisters. One last time, that's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life. When you head to smalls.com/sisters. The link is in our show notes.
If you have a question for us, please email sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us on social media using the hashtag sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question during the show, we'll try to answer it during our newest show, Sisters Sidebar, where we take your questions every Wednesday. You know, it's so exciting because this really is our favorite part of the show, and now we get to get together twice a week to answer your questions. So we'll get started for today. Barb, I have a question for you. It's from Megan, and she asks, if House and Senate sign off on adding more Supreme Court justices, could the Supreme Court itself stop that?
Oh, what an interesting case. Very existential. I don't think so. You know, Article 3 of the Constitution establishes a judicial branch, and it vests the judicial power in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress may establish. And the number of justices has always been set by Congress. We've had 5, 7, now 9. And so if the court were to expand to, say, 13 or some other number, I think Congress can do that. Now, if they try to do things like term limits, I think justices are appointed for life in the Constitution. I think they couldn't do that. But in terms of expanding the number, I think Congress can do it, and I don't think the courts could do anything about it.
So our next question, I think I'll take this one. It comes from NBDYIMPT, Nobody Important, maybe, at bluesky.social. And it's a great question. They ask, what are law schools going to do about the demise of legal ethics? So I have some thoughts, but y'all feel free to jump in, because when the three of us went to law school, I'm going to hazard a guess that ethics was not the most important topic in any of our minds. You know, ethics, you had to take a bar exam on it, just like a mini exam. But everybody understood what ethics were. There weren't big questions in our mind. It was sort of routine. And I think now it is no longer routine. It's fresh, it's important, it's interesting. In the Democratic Institutions seminar that I taught in the spring, my students really dug in on the reading, and we had some very engaged conversations. And so I think, frankly, that what law schools do will be driven by student interest. I think it's at an all-time high, and this is a new reinvigorated topic that people care about. What are y'all seeing?
No, I think that that's right. I mean, law school applications have gone up. I'm on the advisory board of a center that encourages law students to pursue public jobs in the public sector. And you're seeing a lot of people really wanting to do that. And it's just right now, young people, including my mentees, are really, really motivated to go to law school to do good work and to fix what's broken. So I think that it will come in a way, maybe swinging back in a way that it's taken for granted. It comes naturally that ethics is important for these students. So I think the pendulum is swinging back in that area. I hope I'm right.
I think so. As a law professor, I think I am seeing a renewed interest in ethics, both from the institutional perspective and making sure that it is emphasized and looking for more opportunities to talk about it, and also for students who are very hungry to do the right thing and also to hold accountable those who don't. So, you know, right now I'm seeing a lot of students interested in state government as opposed to federal government.
Yeah. Same.
They're attracted to the law firms who did not cave to Trump when he was extorting them. They're going to the ones that fought back. So I think they're very tuned in, and they care very much about integrity in the legal profession.
Yeah, I mean, our students really give me a lot of hope at this point. And the fact that we're all engaged with students, right? So many people are mentoring, like you are, Kim, to try to give these students an idea of how it's supposed to be, not how it is now. So it's all very hopeful. Last question is for you. This one comes from Vivian. I like this one. It digs in on an important legal topic. Vivian asks, are universal injunctions still viable after recent Supreme Court signals?
Yeah, so that is a really, really good question. The answer, as far as I can interpret, is sometimes, maybe. So one thing that I thought was really interesting about the Mifepristone case was it in the end, the Supreme Court kept the drug available as it currently was, But the way that it got there was that a federal court made a ruling that would have halted its availability remotely to be, prescribed by telehealth and sent through the mail for everyone. But it wasn't technically a universal injunction. It was an injunction that only applied to the parties in the case, Louisiana. But the way that it was done, there was no way that pharmaceutical companies could comply with that order, just excluding Louisiana. It would have stopped the drugs availability nationwide. So I feel like that was a little loophole that had the Supreme Court okayed and said, oh, no, this does not violate our rule against universal injunctions, would have been catastrophic. And now I worry that there will be other cases where people will try to seek injunctions in that clever way to make it not technically universal, but universally de facto. So that put a new thing in my head that I'm going to be watching out for. So I think your question that you're asking is really an important one. We should not take for granted that universal injunctions will not be imposed.
Yeah, it's an important point and not necessarily a good one, but I think we have to be just clear-eyed when we face these legal challenges. So thank you all for your questions. We really do love getting the opportunity to know what's going on in your minds and to answer some of your questions. Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Joyce Vance. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate the show, send it to a friend. Be sure you follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so that you never miss an episode. Join us every Saturday as we break down the biggest legal developments of the week, and then catch our companion podcast, Hashtag Sisters Sidebar, every Wednesday, where we answer your legal questions. You can shop for Hashtag Sisters-in-Law totes and other goodies at Politicon and follow us on Instagram at sistersinlaw.podcast. And check out the special offers in this episode's show notes from our sponsors, Quince, Delete Me, Thrive Cosmetics, Wild Alaskan, and Smalls. See you next week. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. Can I just say that whoever wrote the line, "Stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts," is a freaking poetic genius.
Yes.
That is the best ad line ever. The best line ever to show up in a Hashtag Sisters-in-Law ad. I'm going to cut that out and just tack it to my wall just to make me laugh when I'm having a bad day.